1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And Joe at RT.ie. Linda Ann, good afternoon, Linda.
Good afternoon.
We've been talking, as you know, for over the last 4 days, indeed, Graeme Taylor, Dean McGuire, Carl Freeman, those three young men who should still be alive. They got involved in crime, over 200 convictions between them. They were killed in a car crash when they drove down the wrong way down a motorway and head-on into a truck. But a lot of their convictions were for burglary, and we've been talking about burglary and then the glorification of their careers, including a screwdriver and a torch on the altar during their funerals. What happened to you last December, Linda Ann?
Yeah, we had been out for the day shopping. The first time we'd been out because we'd been in lockdown for so long.
Of course, yeah.
We had some Christmas shopping to do, so we left in the morning. Came back home about 6 o'clock in the evening, and the first thing I noticed was that the window in the front room was open. And I knew immediately we'd been broken into. I knew we would never have left that open. So, yeah, I ran in headlong into the house, which was probably the wrong thing to do, and straight up the stairs. Found my bedroom completely ransacked. Everything pulled out, and then, of course, I knew that everything precious to me was gone. Everything, you know, precious in a monetary sense, I suppose. I suppose what I hadn't reckoned on was the other things that they would take from me, and that's that feeling of being your home being violated, the vulnerability that you feel after something like that, when you feel that your home is a safe place to be. You know, that thing of now every time we go out, we're double-checking doors are locked, making sure everything is secure, and then trying to get back as quickly as possible, because it's changed everything, really, for us. So, yeah.
They got items of extraordinarily sentimental value.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I suppose every piece of jewellery, and, you know, it was when I started to do the list for the police of actually what was gone, I realised that there was jewellery in there, from my confirmation. You know, I'm 65 now, so there was a lifetime of bits of pieces of sentimental jewellery. But the most sentimental pieces were pieces that my late husband gave me when my two girls were born, and they were meant to be passed down to them. Obviously, I have nothing now. I mean, I was left, obviously, with the jewellery I was wearing, which was precious little because of COVID and hand washing and whatever. I was wearing very little jewellery, so it all went, every piece of it. And that, you know, while it might sound frivolous, it's actually, there's a real grieving process in that, as you think of the memories that are attached to pieces of jewellery and the things that you can't replace because the person who gave them to you is gone.
Because your husband was killed in June 1990, which is 31 years ago from what you tell me. He was in his early 30s.
He was 30, yeah. Yeah, and my girls were 3 and 5 at the time. So these are really, you know, they were precious pieces of jewellery that we were holding on to. That would be that kind of perpetual memory of their dad and then grandfather and for their children, whatever.
And can I ask what happened to your husband, Linda?
He was actually coming to collect me. He and a colleague were coming to collect me and some of my lady friends at the Wild Coast. And they had driven past a roadblock that was actually stopping petrol, stopping cars going back toward Durban.
South Africa, yeah.
And they drove past. They weren't stopping people going into Wild Coast, that area. But they came across somebody who was stuck at the side of the road, and they stopped to give them a hand, and this person needed petrol. And they realised that the nearest petrol station was back toward Durban, so they set off back that way. And then came across a tailback of cars because of the roadblock, so they decided, well, that wasn't going to work. So they turned to go back toward the Wild Coast. And as they were driving away, two soldiers who were a stopper group. They one of them fired a shot at the car, and it went through the tail light and through the two seats and through my husband, who was a passenger. Yeah. So it was just, yeah, I mean, even as I recount it, I mean, they were just such traumatic days.
That's unbelievable.
And we had many traumatic years in South Africa after that, as we went through inquests and court cases and so on. So when we came home here to Dublin in 1995, mm-hmm. we came home to a place that was of safety and security and freedom for the girls, you know, because obviously life out there is very different. So, yeah.
And you said it was a whole feeling of being violated and then your vulnerability.
Sorry, can you say again?
You said it was the feeling of being violated by these burglars. And
absolutely.
Then
thankfully, you know, my daughters came over that night. We couldn't touch anything in the house because the police had obviously had to come. And then we had to leave it all as it was because of the fingerprinting and whatever, and even just looking at the destruction around our home was just really awful. So there's that, and you don't know where they've been or what they've done or what they've touched.
And do you know how they got in? I know they got in.
They got in through
the window.
They broke a security light, and we've a window that comes into the kitchen down the side passage, and they broke the window. They broke the lock on the window. They didn't break the glass. They broke the lock on the window, and got in that way. And they actually, they obviously opened that window. And as the police explained to me, they usually open a second one, so they have a way out because there's deadlocks on our doors. So there was no way they could get out or open a door from the inside.
Okay, say with us, Linda. Joe at rt.ie, 1857-15-815. Pat Murray is in Clondalkin. And you say there are a lot of break-ins in Clondalkin. You've been broken into twice, but didn't upset you?
No, I didn't say it didn't upset me,
sorry.
Joe. I feel so, so sorry for that lady and what she went through. But we've been broken into twice.
Right.
The first time I came down the stairs and they ran out. But the second time, my husband and myself were fast asleep and we knew nothing till we came down the next morning. Now, a neighbour across the road has really good CCTV and he has a camera facing the front of our house. And we were able to watch two bucks pull up in a car.
Mm-hmm.
One went around the back, broke in through my back door, came through the house and opened the front door for his friend. And they came in and they emptied all the possessions they could get their hands on downstairs into the boot of our own car. And then one fella drove off in our car and the other book drove off in his car.
So they used your own car to rob your own house?
Yes, and they took a leg of lamb out of the freezer.
Good God. They took everything, in other words.
In everything, everything that they could get their hands on, you know, our TV, our phones. I had taken off a bit of jewellery, as you do when you're sitting watching the telly, and put it on. But what I wanted to say was...
And the second time, Pat?
Well, that was previous to that. And
okay.
They didn't get... Well, they got phones and the like, but they didn't get... Like, this time they cleaned us out, practically. It was very inconvenient trying to get it. We had an old car, and I have a back issue, so I need an automatic and all. And it was difficult to find a second-hand car, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But that was the only inconvenience. But my point was, I wasn't traumatised.
Okay, well done.
Yeah, no, but it's only stuff at the end of the day. We'd had an old dog here and he had died. Now, if he'd have been alive and they'd have kicked him, or even worse, if my husband had woke up, he'd have probably come down and had a go at them. And God knows where we'd be today.
So what you kind of said afterwards, it's only money.
It's only stuff at the end of the day, yes, exactly. And it can be replaced. I know the bracelet had been bought by one of my sons.
Yeah.
And but look, it was gold. You can get another piece of gold. And that lady, even though it was
Linda,
Linda. I think Linda should go and buy her daughters, in her husband's memory, a piece of jewellery, and they can then treasure that. There's always a solution. And don't be carry around the hurt all the time. You know, try to deal with it.
And did you ring the guards, Pat?
Oh, of course we did, and the guards came up and. We had those toll tag on the car, so we were able to go online and watch our car going down to Portlaoise, back up to Dublin, down to Portlaoise again. So we reckon our car was being bloody used, maybe to do other people's houses. But we got nothing back anyway.
And were they ever caught?
Not at all, not at all. These are professionals, Joe. That's their career.
Yeah, but there's no other career where when someone works on their, pursues their career, you have to ring the guards because they're breaking the law. They're criminals.
I know, but they see it as their livelihood. They feel entitled to break into my house and your house. They just feel entitled. I have no idea why. I reared three sons myself, and I would hope that 99% of the population that reared them to have respect for other people and their property.
But they break into your house because it's easy money.
Yeah.
And they don't mind who they terrify. You weren't terrified, but they don't mind who they terrify. If there was work in bed, they'd sleep on the floor.
Yeah, it's a sad state of affairs. It's a sad society that we're living in. But it's worldwide. It's not just us. But I just feel people should not live in terror because of it. That, you know, you should try to deal with it.
Linda?
They're just couriers.
Courier now is a small word for... Courier is something Sean O'Casey would use in The Plough of the Stars. The fellas with little boxcars running down the street, breaking a bottle of milk or something. As we heard the other day, like one victim of one of the three people we're talking about, Carl Freeman, gave an powerful impact statement about how it had completely changed her life and died shortly afterwards. Linda, what do you think of what Pat's saying? Get over it and go into Weir's and buy two new rings and...
That just doesn't go anywhere close to it, you know. My girls were babies when their daddy died, so there were precious memories of him and the reason why he gave the kids. So that, they're just irreplaceable. And I do know they are only things. And at the end of the day, you can replace it all if you wish. But you can't replace the sentiment. But beyond that, it's the feeling that somebody has been in your home and not knowing whether they've been watching you and waiting for the opportunity, not knowing whether it was just opportunists. And the fact, that's unfortunate, that lady's experience was dreadful and she'd been broken into twice in awful circumstances. But I'd never been broken into before and I assumed that we never would be. And that whole kind of safe feeling of safety at home is gone.
So, Pat, what would you say? Like, how quickly did you get over it?
Well, to be honest,
hardest part for us was trying to get a car that we could drive. I'm not going to say that we were blasé about it and went, oh, that's the end of it. Of course we were upset. But what I'm trying to say is I'm old myself, I should say. We're both retirees. But to be carrying that around, when I think back to the awful things that happened in my life, that doesn't even come up there. You know, with family being ill and people dying. Those yobbos breaking into my house, they are not going to ruin my life. I can't even relate to Linda because it's so horrific and how I would deal with that if my husband had been gone and they were so precious.
Yeah. And Pat, were the individuals caught? No, you said they weren't. Were the bios, as you call them, were they caught? If they were caught and if you were in court and if you were asked by the judge, would you like to say something before I sentence these three men or five men or two men or whatever, what would you say?
I'd say the bloody cheek of them breaking into my home. How dare they? Send them to jail, Judge. What would anybody say, Joe? But leave it at that. Leave it behind you. Don't carry it around for the rest of your life. Life's hard enough for us all.
And what do you think about as Archbishop Dermot? I don't know if we have the Archbishop Dermot Martin clip somewhere there. I don't know what you heard. Archbishop Dermot Martin talking about these funerals, not these specific funerals, but this type of funeral that's become very common in recent years, especially in the Dublin area. This is Archbishop Dermot Martin.
I lived in Italy. I watched the Mafia for many years. It's a classic thing that these people, when it comes to one of their major people being damaged, that they go for a show funeral. Now, the thing about these show funerals is that the very young people who we want to keep out of this will be attracted by this. Secondly, who pays for a show funeral? It's the same drug money And they shouldn't be using the church for that. I mean, we will provide and do provide religious services for the bereaved, for families who are bereaved, but not to have sort of gatherings of the comrades of these people to be able to show off. Priests, you know, every day are dealing with families who are bereaved. They know, and they have to say to priests, to people, look, this particular song wouldn't be appropriate at a funeral, and people accept it. If you know, and this will go on with some of the families of those involved in these recent this recent violence. But if they begin to say, no, we want something different, then we can say, well, look, please, that isn't suitable, go somewhere else. If people, you know, are insisting on things which go beyond, and you know, not just sort of the sort of solemn arrival of remains in the church, but even sometimes what's being said or done in a church, you know, the entire church would have to say simply, no, this isn't appropriate.
Isn't that one of the things that's changed, Pat, maybe over your lifetime, my lifetime, that there has been in recent years an almost glorification of crime?
And Joe, what percentage of our community is that referring to? To me, that was lads posturing. It's part of their lad culture. Of all the thousands and thousands of funerals that's been had, there are two funerals that we know of.
Three, yeah.
Well, we only know two that were over the top. I don't know the third one.
Okay.
I mean, I think I pity the families because I'd say it was taken out of their hands by the...
By who?
By the gang that they were that they're affiliated with, whatever they... I don't imagine their parents gave them that send-off, Joe.
Well, the parents were there. Well, OK, leave that question there. That's a good question. That's a good question, Pat. Jane, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
OK, all burglary stories are creepy. Creepers, they call burglars in the trade. But this is a creepy burglary, double burglary story. Tell us.
A double burglary story. It's kind of a positive story. That's why I texted in. So my mum passed away when I was 8. She had skin cancer, actually, so put on your sunscreen. It's very hot. But about 10 years ago, my dad's house got broken into. The place was turned upside down and all my mum's jewellery was missing. Now, this would be her engagement ring, you know, various bits and pieces that I would have remembered her wearing as a kid. So a lot of sentimental stuff.
Okay.
And then, you know, I was devastated, obviously. I'd searched everywhere for it, really, really devastated. And then 10 years later, the same house, my dad's house, was broken into again. He didn't have the cop on to get an alarm in that 10 years. But the house got broken into again, and, you know, I was long moved out of the house. So I went back and I helped him clean up. You know, he's there on his own and... You know, the place was upside down. So as I was, like, cleaning everything up, putting everything back in its drawers, I found my mum's old makeup bag filled with all of her jewellery that had obviously been pushed to a back of a wardrobe 10 years ago in the first burglary and then resurfaced 10 years later. So it was kind of a happy silver lining story.
So the second burglary led you to do an even greater search of the house, and that's how you discovered your... By the way, was anyone ever caught for either burglary?
No, not at all. And, you know, it wasn't even that I did a search. The bag itself had been thrown onto my dad's bed, but I guess the burglars didn't realise that there was a lot of jewellery inside it. It was just the makeup bag that she used to own. No one was caught.
And
no.
I see you say... I don't know how you know this, but you said my teenage diaries were read by the burglars.
Well, actually, that was another time. I've been burgled a few times in my life. When I was about 21, I was living in a student house and I had loads of diaries and things, and everything had been ripped out. All my like 10 different diaries had been opened, and it's just very violating, you know. It's not even about what they took. I think they just took some Nike runners, actually. It's not like we had anything at that age. At 21, didn't have any money. But it's just that someone was in your space. It's not nice.
And what benefit does anyone get from reading someone else's diary?
I don't know. I think it might have been... I have a suspicion of who it might have been around the time of the burglary. you know, young lads were calling to the door saying they were looking for sponsors for a sponsored walk, but didn't have any materials with them, that kind of thing. So,
but you mentioned the reading of the diary made you feel violated in that sense, which is interesting. Well, a diary is a very, very private thing, very private.
Yeah.
Linda, I know it was last December, but how are you now?
I'm okay day to day, you know. Okay. I look after my grandchildren 3 days a week, and they're a great distraction. And my mum, who's 93, stays with us quite a bit. In fact, she was staying with us through lockdown, so I'm just glad she wasn't here when anything happened. No, I'm fine. It's just there are just times, you know, that the kind of that feeling kind of washes over you. It's almost like grief in some way for the stuff that's gone and can't be replaced, but also just the reality of the fact that this happened.
By the way,
perhaps that I'm naive and perhaps I'm unusual, but we've never been broken into before.
I don't know. I don't think you are.
It's very much a first for me.
That's why burglary is a crime.
Yes,
then, Linda, did anything ever come of the people who shot your husband?
Oh, well, that was a soldier who shot him. And the inquest found that while the shooting was unlawful, that this was South Africa, 1990, and the defence forces had to be allowed to do their job anyway, they saw fit. This is why I fought that right through to the highest court in the land, because as we would win a case, the defence forces would actually appeal it.
Wow.
And I remember very shortly after Ashwin died, we met with Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Okay.
And he prayed with us that the sacrifice of Ashwin's life and the burden that we were asked to carry because of that, that it would not be for nothing, but out of it something good could come. And the final finding in that was that, in fact, that at roadblocks, they were not allowed to use live ammunition as the only way to stop a vehicle, that they would have to have fast pursuit vehicles or calthrops that they throw across the road. That it was just totally unacceptable. That the only way they could have done that night was with a live round.
And you believe...
A live round and a hollow point bullet.
Good God.
So, I mean, it was designed to do maximum damage when it hit.
Pretty fatal.
So, yeah.
Do you... Was it the belief that was your husband of colour? In other words,
my husband was Indian. Yeah.
So do you believe that was germane to why?
I'm not sure they could have told. It was a very dark night. It was just a car, and his colleague was a white. It was just a car, and it had turned on a roadblock, and they just didn't like that. So
that legitimately
and in
turned.
In fact, I mean, the judge who found for us said, you know, that anybody has a right not to go through a roadblock if it's going to actually delay you. You have a right to turn and not go through it. So, yeah, there were lots of little findings as it went on. It didn't bring Ashwin back, unfortunately.
How did you? Where did you meet?
We met here. He was at the College of Surgeons.
Okay.
And we met here when there weren't very many people of colour living in Ireland. So everybody knew when they saw you with somebody of colour that he must have been from the College of Surgeons.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we married here in 1984 and moved out to South Africa.
And did the Irish government take an interest in the case at the time?
It's interesting that at the time Ashwin had applied for an Irish passport and all his details were at the consulate in Johannesburg. But I wasn't offered consular assistance or anything at the time. But they wrote back to me in response to a letter that I wrote to them and just said they were very sorry. But beyond that, no, there was nothing.
Okay. Stay with us, Linda. Mark is in County Kildare. Mark, good afternoon. Another burglary story. What happened here? It gets weirder and weirder. Go ahead.
How are you, Joe? How are you doing?
Good, Mark. Yeah, thanks.
Joe, it was a long time ago, Joe. But I suppose they came into the house. I came home from work late that night, maybe about 2:30, 3:00 in the morning. I was driving a taxi at the time. And I got up the next morning and I opened up the back door and I realised it wasn't locked, And I said to myself, oh, that's strange. And then I realised that the barrel had been popped in the back door. Mm-hmm. So then I started to investigate, you know, obviously somebody had been in the house and what was missing.
Okay.
And I'd left some money in the kitchen drawer that I made the night before for my wife the next morning to go shopping. And obviously that was gone. Her wedding ring was gone. My daughter's mobile phone was taken. And I suppose the horrible thing was that they rang me the next day, that day, on my daughter's mobile phone and said to me, how are you doing? Do you know who this is? Mm-hmm. And I says, obviously, you know, you're the guy that has my daughter's mobile phone. Now, she was only a young child at the time. You know, I got 15. And he goes, yeah, he says, you know, we were in your house last night. And I said, yeah, okay. And he says, what do you want? And he goes, I just want to let you know that I closed the door after me. So okay. I said, oh, that's great. Thanks very much. And yeah. He says, did you get the keys to your car? He says, I left in your ignition.
All right.
And I says, oh, that's very good of you.
Yeah.
And he says, so you've nothing to worry about. He says, you're full and plenty. And I said, do you think so?
You've nothing to worry about, Mark. You've what?
Yeah, you've nothing to worry about. You're full and plenty.
You're full and plenty.
Yeah. Because of where we're living, Joe, you know.
You just saw what they were doing. Yeah. It's like the Fox Rock phenomenon we heard the other day. Ah, it's Fox Rock. Where did they get their money from? Nonsensical arguments.
Yeah.
They believe what they believe because you had worked and earned money, they had a right to take some of it.
I don't know what was going through their minds, Joe, you know. I mean, who can ever work out what's going through the minds of a guy that actually rings you the next day, and he rang my mother as well, he went through my daughter's phone list and
what did he say to your mother?
He just rang her, he says, how are you doing? He says, we were in your granddaughter's house last night.
Good God.
My mother got a fright and she just hung up and then she rang me.
Yeah.
You know, she obviously knew, like, you know, that I was after telling her that morning that we're after being burgled.
But did your daughter's number come up when your nan's phone or nan's phone
it
was?
It did, yeah. It would have come up, obviously. But he identified himself.
And you
they
say,
robbed three houses on the road that night, Joe. They, you know, it's funny the things they, well, I won't say funny, maybe that's the wrong choice of words, but they opened the fridge and they took the young boy, you know, a bottle of orange that it was in the fridge for his school the next morning for his lunch. You know, they took that and they drank that and they had some sweets and stuff. They went across the house, across the road, and apparently they opened their fridge and they sat in the sitting room. The woman was in her, at the time, the woman was in the house on her own. She was in bed. And they sat down inside in our sitting room and they had something to eat and they had something to drink. And the next morning when the neighbours were out on the road, looking around the road, there was, you know, wrappers of sweets and yogurt pots on the road.
So in other words, they were totally at home in a house they'd burgled.
Yeah, yeah. Same so, Joe. They took a BMW then at the time on a neighbour, and he was very upset because his baby's buggy was in the boot, and he said that he didn't care so much about the car but he needed the buggy, you know.
Were they ever caught? Did you ever hear them again?
They rang a radio show about maybe 4 or 5 days later, a late night talk show.
Okay.
And they were boasting and bragging that they had been up in the area and that they'd robbed some houses in Selbridge and they'd robbed some houses in Clane, and you know, they'd taken a BMW and they'd taken a Mini Cooper at the time. And the radio presenter said, like, listen, there was a buggy in the boot of the car. Is there any chance that you could get the buggy back to the gentleman that you took the car on? And apparently then the guys recovered the BMW and the buggy was still in the boot.
Okay.
You know, it's funny the things that upset you, Joe, but I just remember my neighbour at the time being so upset about the buggy being taken.
Well, you know, I think there have been two cases in Dublin the last 10, 15 years where cars have been stolen with children in the car seat that the thief apparently didn't see when he jumped in and robbed the car. Anyway, Mark, thanks indeed. Jane, thanks indeed. Pat yeah. Murray, thanks indeed. And Linda, Linda, thanks indeed. That's Linda who told us that incredible, horrific story of what happened to her husband. A number of people are now recalling it because it was a big story here as well. Ashwin, who was killed by the South African Defence Forces in 1990. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Marks and Spencer's, one of the big, big operations in Ireland. Very, very, well, I know it's changed with Dunn's Lady, but very different offering, especially in the food front. But a lot of their products are missing from the shelves lately. Katrina, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What did you go into? What did you go into? Look for and collect?
Well, just bedwear basically, and just found that they didn't have the same service there.
Okay.
The staff, were, of course, were really good, but I just didn't find that they had the stock basically, and it went on weeks before they got it.
And have you ever encountered that before in M&S?
No.
Okay. What about did you go down to their food hall, which is famous?
Yes, I found the food hall had low stocks of food. Yeah.
Well, if you listen to, we're going to play him now, Archie Norman, who's the chairman of M&S. I woke up to this at 6 o'clock this morning on BBC Radio 4, and I nearly tore off my sweaty nightcap. Such was the apocalyptic vision, and it's going to be a difficult one, he has painted, of what's happening in the Republic and what will happen in the Republic and what's happening in Northern Ireland, all because of Brexit.
At the moment, only about 80% of our product is getting into Ireland. So 20% doesn't arrive at all. And that means, obviously, the Irish customers are not seeing large parts of the M&S range. And that applies to other retailers as well. And it's not the rules of the customs union that is the problem. It's the Byzantine and pointless and honestly pettifogging enforcement, which means that wagons can't get through. Each wagon typically of our wagons has about 8 documents, 720 pages per truck. I mean, that's 3 large books. It's about 40,000 pages of documentation per week. And to do that, we're employing 13 full-time vets. They're not looking after animals or welfare. They're simply ticking boxes and filling out forms. So take a sandwich. You know, it might have some mayonnaise, some butter, some cream, or some meat in it. Sandwiches typically require about 3 vet certificates to get through. If the typeface on one page is the wrong color, it's rejected. 40% of our wagons have been delayed. And a delay means could be 6 hours, but often it's 24 to 48 hours, which means that most of the content of that wagon will have to be destroyed.
Yeah.
And remember, there's 500 lines that we produce, which are actually banned from the European Union. So free-range chicken can't go into the European Union. Mm. You know, our best-ever burgers can't go in. You know, even orchids.
It's a pretty apocalyptic vision for those who like Marks and Spencer. A lot of people do. And by the way, a lot of people employed, over 2,500 people employed in Ireland. But the other thing he went on to say, Katrina, as well, anyone who looks forward to, you know, the way Marks and Spencer's at Christmas do a big, unique food offering in terms of turkeys and special puddings and special drinks. He said they've already delisted a lot of them for the Republic because they won't be able to get them in. So Marks and Spencer's is going to change. Did you say anything, Katrina, to the staff? Because they must be fed up being asked, where's the food from here, there and everywhere. Did you say anything to the staff?
Yes, and the staff obviously didn't want to agree with you. But yeah, you could see that they were having problems with the whole situation, and this was I'm not surprised, because this is what Brexit is doing to the south of Ireland and to Northern Ireland.
But surely, even I know they voted for Brexit, but 40,000 pages, this is Marks and Spencer's alone, coming into Republic, or presumed through Dublin port, and we all know the trucks, they're the white trucks with the logo on the side. He's saying for their trucks every week coming into Republic, they have to fill out 40,000 pages. It's not digitised. He's had to employ 13 vets which is a very well-educated profession. Therefore, you pay for vets. He's had to employ 13 vets, not to do any veterinary work, but they have to fill out this form, this petty fucking bureaucracy, as he calls it. 20% of the products are gone out of the Irish stores, and they of the 40% are delayed, and a lot of the product that's delayed has to be destroyed because of the best before date. As that doesn't tell me Marks and Spencer are going to stay in the Republic.
I wouldn't be. I'm absolutely sure they won't stay here, and we can't get the products we used to get. And this was all predicted, unfortunately, by the Brexiteers. And I don't think they're too worried about this, obviously.
Well, you see, the story, it's interesting, the news angle that was taken up, including by the Irish Times, out of the Archie Norman story, the Archie Norman statement was that Northern Ireland is going to be affected next Christmas. We're already affected, badly.
Yeah. It's a dreadful situation, but that's only one issue of the whole Brexit scenario. I know myself, I had another issue trying to get a car sensor, wheel sensor, and it was delayed weeks and weeks on end. So the impact is only coming home now, as I said. It's affecting everybody.
But there's no going back, and I'm just wondering, is there any way, for example, of Dublin Port reducing and Revenue and Customs reducing that bureaucracy of 40,000 printed pages? That's many volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. That's just one company in 1 week, hand filled out by hand, and if you use a blue pen instead of a black pen, go back to the end of the queue.
I think Boris Johnson needs to hear about this.
Well, he has heard about it. He ain't going anywhere.
No.
But I'm saying we are where we are. Is there any way we could make this easier? Because we're the country that's going to be most affected.
Well,
outside of the UK, the biggest group of M&S stores is in the Republic. Not in France or Germany or whatever, it's in the Republic. Once again, we're going to get it in the neck. Okay, will you continue shopping in M&S, Katrina? That's the other thing. People go in and they see things missing and they don't get their usual chicken or turkey or meats or whatever. They might say, well, I won't come here again.
Well, Joe, I'll probably go from time to time, but obviously I will lose interest and, you know, it will. And I think lots of my neighbours and friends will do the same. That's what the impact
and
will be.
Having the likes of Dunn Stores completely and totally in the last 5 or 10 years, completely and totally upped the quality of their product in terms of their offerings and food halls.
Of course.
It's incredible.
That's where we'll go elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Katrina, good to meet you, Margaret. Katrina, 51551. No, it's the text number. Don't say watch your hand. What? Greg.
Yeah, Greg. How are you, Joe?
Okay, you're a lorry driver. Tell us.
Yeah, your man's blaming all the troubles on the Irish customs.
Yeah, Archie Norman, yeah.
Right, well, if he'd done the right paperwork, there wouldn't be a problem in the Dublin customs.
40,000 pages a week for M&S.
And tell him to his staff are doing them wrong. Do them right.
How are they doing them wrong?
Well, yeah, as he said, if they fill in the wrong colour paperwork, they're filling in the wrong forms. That's the only, the Dublin customs are there and the vets are there to clear the load. If the paperwork's right and the vet certs and everything's right, they don't stop it.
Okay, 720 pages per truck, per M&S truck. You get through a blue, black big biro in 720 pages.
No,
and who do you work for, Greg? In terms of
different companies.
And what's the paperwork been like for you?
It doesn't matter. Like, yeah, and could hold it up if the paperwork's wrong. Foodstuffs needs a vet.
Yeah, of course. Because
right.
Yeah.
Now, the vet cert mightn't be in it. Now, one of the problems is you get your beef and onion soup.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, there's no vet cert, and the vet are checking it here. Why is there no vet cert? And then when they look at the tin, there's no beef in it. It's soya beans.
Okay.
But it's advertised as beef and whatever, onion soup. Do you know what I mean?
And have you been held
that
up?
That can hold up. Yeah, no, that can hold up. No, but it's only quick formality. You go in, they open up the side of the trailer, have a look at the tin.
What was it like before Brexit?
You didn't stop. You just kept going.
Just kept going, yeah.
But I mean, the problem is with the paperwork coming into the country, not the Irish customs. The Irish customs aren't sitting down there saying, "Ah, we'll hold this up for the
fun." Well, they're enforcing the fact that the UK voted to leave the EU.
Together and done the paperwork right and included whatever paperwork is necessary, then the truck's not going to be held up. Yeah. It's that simple, and that's all you have to say to them.
Yeah, but I'd love to say that to him, but the problem...
Well, what they're doing is they're blaming everyone apart from themselves.
Yeah, but the problem is that M&S are so big and they're back in profitability again, that he might decide, Archie Norman might decide, well, it's not worth our while going in and out of the Republic.
Good. There's plenty of Irish producers.
Yeah, but there's 2,000 jobs in Marks and Spencer's. I'm sorry, Greg.
I'm sure maybe Duns will take them over, or Pennies or someone. Do you know what I mean? Why should we buckle because they can't do the paperwork right?
Okay.
Like, that's what you're basically saying, Joe.
And have you travelled from Ireland through the UK to the continent?
No, done it years ago. No.
So you're saying, okay.
You know what I mean? All you have to do is do the paperwork right and then there's no hold.
Do you shop in Marks and Spencer's yourself, Gregory?
No.
Why not?
Just don't.
Just not need.
That's not my job. That's your job.
Okay, well, it does. Okay, Greg, safe travelling. Bye-bye.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815. Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Tom Connolly, good afternoon. 51551 is the text number. You were, unfortunately, you were burgled only a few weeks ago.
On the 6th of July, Joe.
And what happened?
I leave very early every morning for work.
Okay, good.
Around 4, maybe shortly after us.
Wow.
And that particular morning, I was going out.
Yeah.
And I noticed I had a light left on in the kitchen, and I went back in to switch it out. I live about 100 metres and off the road.
Okay.
And when there was a church down the road a little bit from me, when I was going down by the church, this car was stopped at the church. I thought it peculiar that there'd be someone there that hour in the morning, past no remarks. Well, I said, when I go back, and I said, no, I have to be here and I have to be there. Just to think. So when I came back that day, I was going for my second vaccine injection that day, and I came back at 12:30.
Right.
And my God, Joe, when I came in, the place was wrecked.
Ah. And what had they taken?
They had, I had a lot of old coin, two shillings and half crowns.
Okay.
An old gentleman died a few years ago and left it to me.
All right.
And that's what they brought. Now, they went to stoop so low, they even pulled the lagging jacket off the cylinder. They got up in the attic, they pulled the mattresses apart.
Yeah.
Drawers that would only come out so far, 3/4 ways, they brought them out the whole way.
They wrecked them, yeah.
You know, wrecked the place.
And
my neighbour, I have a very good neighbour here, and I brought him in to see the poor man there nearly died with a heart attack.
The state your
house. I have a few good goodies in the guards of Mullingar, and I rang them, and within a few minutes they were out.
Yeah.
And they were very good.
And do you have you any idea how many who broke into your house? How many?
I don't know. I said it could have been two, Joe.
Yeah,
I said it could have been watch out man in the car and the other guy came in.
Yeah, it's obviously two, yeah.
Now, I have an alarm system which was put in 22 years ago, and thanks to God I've upgraded it ever since. But they got in by that. They got in by that. Do you know?
And did they use a screwdriver to break into
it? Oh, used a screwdriver, yeah. To try the back door first, and I had a pin in that couldn't be opened. So then they got in the front window. They smashed the front window and in they got. And they had plenty of time, because they obviously knew my movement. I wouldn't be back home until sometime in the afternoon each day, you know.
And what, Tom, you're great getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning. What do you do?
A meat man.
Oh, good man. Good man. Fair play to you now. How long have you been doing that?
Oh, just 36 years.
Ah, fantastic. Fantastic. How many days a week are you doing it now?
Well, the hours I work about 8 days, but six.
You do 6 days?
Yeah, 6 days.
At 4 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, Monday to Saturday.
And you work for yourself, so to speak?
Yeah, I work for myself, yeah. I work with Jan B.
Yeah, you deliver for them, yeah. 36 years up at 4 o'clock every morning, 6 days a week.
Yeah.
That must be a record.
I don't know, but that's it.
And what time do you go to bed at?
Oh, I need very little rocking now, Joe, when I lay down. Yeah. About, Well, during the soccer time, I was, it was 10 o'clock, I was breaking all rules. I usually go around 9 or half 9, you know.
Okay, go
but
on,
man. I don't need any rocking. When I lie down, lights out.
You don't need anyone to rock you to sleep.
No. I don't need anyone to rock me to sleep. No.
Tom, why did they tear the lagging jacket off your immersion?
Because they obviously thought there was money in it. Ah. They thought there was money hidden somewhere, Joe.
And would they have known you were a milkman?
Would have, yeah, yeah. I had a briefcase that a friend of mine gave me for Christmas one time back a few years ago. And the only time I'd use it would be at Christmas time. I'd put the Christmas tree up and it'd raise it up a bit in the room. And that was actually, they actually tore that apart. Thinking there was money in it, yeah.
And
but it's an awful sensation to know that something has been in the house, you know.
And how were you after that then?
The guys in Wollongong were very good. And there was a lady, a crime prevention officer, they wrote to me in different things. You'd be a bit nervous, Joe.
Nervous. I'm just thinking of the service you've given people for 36 years. Is it in and around Mullingar, Tom?
Yeah, we do about 14-mile radius of Mullingar, yeah. Yeah.
And did you ever come across, given that you're out here, did you ever come across other houses being burgled?
No, I never came across. I came across different things, Joe, but never houses being burgled, no. No.
You see, you probably know why. Your routine is so strong that burglars would know, well, there's no point going up that road because Tom will be, the milkman comes down.
Yeah.
And yeah,
different things, but never, no, the odd time, it must have been 20 years ago, yes.
Yeah.
We were out the country one morning and I noticed the van in the street and I rang the boys in Wollongar and within a few minutes there was somebody out to him. Yeah, and they nabbed them that morning. That must be, that's 20 years ago. Yeah.
So 6 days a week, 36 years. Do you get a holiday? You must get a holiday.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, good man. Yeah. Okay.
In fact, you were talking to my partner there a few weeks ago, a couple of months ago.
Okay.
She rang you about getting to Australia.
Okay. Did you get to Australia? No, she didn't.
No.
There's no going to Australia now.
You probably remember. She the poor lady was sick at the moment.
Oh, God. Sorry to hear that. But you and Thomas, is milk door delivery going, disappearing?
No. There's still guys doing milk door deliveries. I would do most of the Tesco's and Dunn's and Super Value's and the Macy's and Spencer's and
Oh, you do
like
them
that.
As well as
and
as,
I do a lot of offices and factories and stuff like that where shifts will be coming in early in the morning and that's the reason why, you know.
Good man.
I have a few guys with me and I'd be getting up to get stuff ready for them in the morning and have stuff ready when they'd come in, and that's it.
Great. And how did you manage during the pandemic? You just walked away. You had to walk away.
Just walked
it's
away.
An essential
we were
service.
An essential services show.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, it's a sad sight now. Going to the nursing homes, which we do a lot of them, and most days we went there was a funeral or two maybe leaving. You know,
good God.
And it puts you to think and say, like, my God, you know.
And is it true? Not that you would know, but from your, is it true that quite a number of nursing homes have actually closed down around the country? That's what I've been hearing in the last few weeks.
No, the ones I'm dealing with, no, are very, very strong.
Okay. And by the way, so to come back to the burglary, which happened 3 or 4 weeks ago, you reckon they used a screwdriver?
2 weeks ago yesterday.
2 weeks.
Oh,
2 weeks.
6th of July. I never forget.
Okay, well, that's a very fair point. Two weeks ago yesterday, 6th of July, you'll never forget it. But what did you, given that screwdriver was used in your case, what do you think of the screwdriver up on the altar?
It's ridiculous. I'm very surprised that the present Archbishop hasn't said something about that, you know.
Well, the previous Archbishop has made it.
He has, yeah.
But the current Archbishop says...
The man that's there now is a Mullingar man.
Oh, is he, yeah?
Yeah.
And did he ever speak out about crime in Mullingar, if there was any crime?
No, not at that particular stage. No, he was a very nice man when he was
there.
Yeah,
I'm sure he is. A very well-educated man. Yeah, okay. Tom, you mind yourself. You deserve an award. We had a competition once on the Gay Bourne Show for Milkman of the Year, way back in the day, with Alice O'Sullivan and people like that. I think, have you ever got an award for your longevity, for your service to the...
No, not yet, but probably it's coming.
It's coming, it is coming.
Yeah.
Okay.
Joe, thank you very much for
Tom, Tom, I'm sorry you were broken into, but that's Tom pronounce your name again for me, Cornally.
Cornally. C-O-R-N-A-L-L-Y, Cornally.
Good Westmeath name. Okay, Tom, good to meet him all good. Slán, Joe at RT, and regards to your wife, 51551, text number.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Joe at RT.ie. The fire engines were out again last night past my house, non-stop on their way to Howth. Pat Coldrick. Pat, good afternoon.
Hi Joe, how's it going?
You live there, you contacted us, what's happening?
Well, we're in a very bad situation here for the last 3 weeks or so, Joe. Basically the Hill of Howth has been on fire, and it's just relentless. I mean, the fire brigade have been doing fantastic work, and with the aid of the Air Corps as well. But it's just the weather has been just so dry and hot that it's setting alight all the gorse bushes up around Somali Hill, above Howth Golf Club, all that area. And, you know, they've been putting it out, and then it would start again, and putting it out, and then the next day it would start somewhere else. So,
but is this not in one sense, is it not an annual occurrence out in Howth, no?
Well, it's never been as bad as this, as far as I can see. I've been living here for the last 30 years, Joe, and even though there's been sporadic fires over the years, but nothing as consistent as this. This is the worst it's ever been, you know?
And is it still alight?
Well, there's another fire seemingly starting again there today, up on another section up the hill. So, you know, they'd put out one fire, and then somewhere else it would start alight again, Joe.
And have you any idea where how the fires are starting? Well, obviously.
Well, this is the question. I don't think it's malicious. As most people would know, the gorse bushes, when they dry, they're very, very flammable, and it doesn't take an awful lot to set them alight. So I would say it's probably old broken glass, and when the sun shines and that, it's having that kind of magnifying heat effect, and it just sets it alight. The trouble with the gorse, Joe, is that it's so inaccessible up on the Hill of Howth and some of the parts, and the gorse is so thick that on the surface the fire might go out, but underneath it would be like a coal fire. The embers are still burning, and it would just take a gust of wind to set that off again, you know?
And what is the effect of it? It doesn't actually reach the houses, surely?
Well, it's come very close to the backs of the houses on Somali Hill. Now, in fairness to the fire brigade, they have dug sort of fire breaks about 30 metres away from any house. So none of the houses are in immediate danger, as far as I can see. But it's also the smoke has been over the hill for the last 3 weeks or so. And if a certain wind direction, I mean, you're literally breathing in that smoke, and it's all over cars, and it's terrible. It really is bad this year.
And by the way, people know he has a guitarist, Pat. It hasn't affected your work, I hope.
No, the fire hasn't affected my work. Unfortunately, it's the COVID situation that has affected work, Joe. Yeah, it's the whole entertainment business. It's in a very dismal situation, unfortunately.
And when you say that, there's no gigs, obviously.
There's no gigs, Joe. No concerts, no gigs for the foreseeable future, as far as I can see. Look, I know the government are doing everything they can, but I really think more emphasis should be put on the entertainment business, particularly the arts, because it is an industry that, as far as I can see, and I've grown up to believe that Ireland, in the eyes of people abroad, and I've travelled abroad, and I've listened to people speaking about Ireland, and all they ever talk about is our music, arts, our culture, our history, and our poetry and writings, you know. So it's a very important industry, and I know a lot of musicians, they're very, very disillusioned at the moment with the whole
situation. Well, I've heard of a few, now you're a younger man, but I've heard of a few older entertainers and musicians saying, this is the end of my career.
Absolutely, yeah. I can sympathise with that, absolutely. Yeah, there's just no light at the end of the tunnel, and for a lot of musicians, they've become totally disillusioned and very unproductive. And it's hard to keep going, to be quite honest, you know. But hopefully, fingers crossed, there's light at the end of the tunnel.
Okay, well, the fire brigade said keep your windows shut, which is very difficult in this hot weather.
It is, and that's the problem with the fires. As I say, if where we are in Sutton, if you get a kind of a southerly wind coming up, which we are at the minute, it's very, very difficult to sleep at night, and you have to close the windows, because otherwise the house will be full of smoke, you know. So,
And then I'm thinking of the firefighters, the men and women of Dublin Fire Brigade, in that awful hot weather, in their gear, trying to damp down a fire.
Joe, only for them, I don't know where we'd be. I mean, they're just doing Trojan work up there. Yeah. And as I say, also the Air Corps helicopter has been, people, a lot of people might have seen them. They're, every 5 minutes they're going down, they're picking up water and then dousing the fires and up and down and up and down and up and down. So it's a great collective effort from the fire brigades and the Air Corps. So in fairness to them.
Pat, keep up the good work in terms of your music. Don't let that go. Don't let the music die.
Absolutely, Joe. It's really what important. I live for, to be honest with you. Yeah. And thanks, good to talk to you.
You're a genius on the guitar, as people know. That's Pat Coldrick, but the reason he contacted was because of the fires, and hope that people be extra, extra vigilant. Please, please, please.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie. I happened to mention to you today that Jimmy and Rosalind Carter, the former president, the great president of the United States of America, both of them still hale and hearty in their 90s, they celebrated their 75th wedding anniversary last week. And then one man jumped out at us, and indeed his wife, so to speak, in that we came across a man called Councillor Ian McGarvey and his wife Marjorie. Now, Ian has many, many accolades to his name. Ian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Joe, and your team.
How are you keeping?
Very, very good.
How long are you married?
67 years.
To the same woman?
To the same woman. I was going to say maybe too long.
To Marjorie. And how's Marjorie keeping?
Marjorie's keeping the same and can keep me motivated the same as ever to do this and do that and do the other things.
Well done. And what age are you, Ian?
91 years.
91, good man. How long have you been a councillor?
Well, since 2004. This is the fourth term. 2004, 2009, 2014 and 2000. And,
so what age were you when you first stood for election?
I must have been 74.
Good man. Good man.
Well, I stood earlier on at an earlier stage in 1974.
Okay.
I was in Fianna Fáil.
Right.
And you know the Jocelyn that was around at that time in Fianna Fáil for business here and there.
Yeah. So you're apparently you're also not just I don't know. Do you reckon you're the longest married couple in Ireland? Both
well,
you still...
I'm not sure, Joe. I never worry about it. It's one day at a time.
Okay, but you're 67 years married.
67 years.
You also became the oldest mayor at 82.
2014. Represented the council in New York at Fifth Avenue on Patrick's Day.
And
represented them on a delegation in Boston. Represented the council in Rudolstadt in Germany on Patrick's Day as well, and Scotland as well. So,
and who named the vine after you?
That was in Rudolstadt.
Rudolstadt.
And the plaque's still hanging on it. It's a vineyard that they actually restored again, and that's what they did while it was there.
They call it the McGarvey, the Ian McGarvey vine.
That's exactly right.
And is it white or red wine?
Red. I'm going to go back to the grapes.
And have you tasted it?
Not yet, no.
And will you drink it?
Well, I do not, Joe. I never touched alcohol in my life.
Wow.
Even wines or nothing else. I never did. No, I never smoked either.
So you never touch alcohol, and now you have a vineyard with a particular vine in your name.
I'll share it with you. You can go ahead and collect it.
And thanks very much. And Ian, was that a decision you made very early that you weren't going to drink?
Well, I put it to you in fairness, Joe. I was very much involved in sport.
Okay.
I was very anxious to do well in sport, particularly in soccer. And I used to run at races and sports and so on. So I determined at that stage to stay fit. I didn't need to be drinking alcohol. No, I didn't need to smoke.
Yeah, great.
So I kept in the first Donegal side in the local town here. They won the Irish Junior Cup as well, played for Sligo Rovers, played for Derry teams and everything else.
And you played for Sligo Rovers?
I did indeed.
And did you ever get a medal?
But you know there were no money then, Joe.
I know that. And did you get to Dalymount or get to...
Well, we played in Dalymount. I played twice in Dalymount in the Junior Cup for the local side.
Okay.
1953, and we won it in 1962.
And if there's another election, Ian, will you go again?
Depends how the engine's running.
And do you stand as a, do you stand as an independent?
Yes, of course. Yes, of course, because I wasn't Fianna Fáil to such times as a... Shall I say, I took a distaste for the way politics has been played. When you look at politics in Ireland, it's conflict everywhere you turn around.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, it's...
And it's about time people like you encourage people that to be able to coexist, which we're educated to do Christianly and otherwise.
And we do coexist in terms of there's no violence on the island.
Yeah.
Is there?
It depends which side you're marching on.
Okay.
But sir, reflect a bit and look at our history. Go back to the time of the famine.
Yeah.
The sad story for Ireland was when the flight of the Irish took place in Rathmullen, just down below me here in 1607.
Okay.
The O'Neills, the Maguires and the O'Donnells.
Mm-hmm.
Then it became an opportunity to bring people in. I think it was about 100 they brought in at the time. And they brought them in to occupy the land that the people held in the six counties. And so you know what's going on since.
Yeah. And would you like to stand?
Until England's gone, and Ireland never would be free.
Okay.
I think it's Pierce said that.
And would you stand for election to the Dáil, Ian?
Well, I did stand with the late Hugh Conaghan as a running mate at one time in 1983.
Okay.
And naturally, it was just the one seat that was to help to secure every last seat, I would say, as much as anything at the time in Fianna Fáil.
And of your 91 years, I know you're only a councillor relatively recently, but how did you make a living, Ian?
Well, I'll tell you one thing, certain sure. I could always make a living because when I was going to school, you'll hardly believe this, I used to go into the local shoemakers, and shoemaking at the time was a great business.
Yeah, shoemakers, yeah.
And I learned to fix shoes, sew on soles and do everything because there were two types of shoes, some of them you could nail the soles on, some of them you had to sew the soles on to be right.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got a bit slightly older then,
okay,
I was able to earn all the pocket money that I needed. And when I started work with a railway company in, at 1947, I was able to hand in all the money to the house, for there were nine of a family, and it wasn't as easy to live in those times. And was able to make all the money that I needed in pocket money.
Great. And did you become a cobbler? Did you become a shoemaker?
Well, I was doing it part-time all the time, even when I started with the railway company. I used to work maybe to 12 o'clock at night because I had so much business at the time that I didn't want to let anybody down. And some of the women around used to say that nobody could fix the shoes the way I could for them because I had a great conceit that when I was learning the trade and was a short time at it, the man that owned the business, he said to me one day, "You mind if I say something to you?" And I says, "You know, you can say what you like." He says, "You're finishing those shoes far too well." And I said, "Why not? So when you like to see them look well finished." He says, "But when you're not here, how will I explain that they weren't as good?"
And then if you're finishing too well, sure, when will anyone ever bring them back to be healed or sold?
Exactly. When I think at such time, Joe, that people had what they called nailed boots.
Yeah, I remember it well.
Three row of nails, maybe around two on the outside and one thing up the centre.
And were they comfortable?
Of course they were comfortable. And heels, iron heels on them and toe plates on them.
So the weight of them?
Well, listen to me, the people were very fit at that time and there's nothing else to do. Keep working.
And would you be involved in trying to raise awareness about drinking, Ian?
Well, at any opportunity, I'll tell you one thing certain, sure. I don't want to pretend to be any martyr for anybody.
Okay, that's fine, yeah. But
I would say to young people there, if I talk to young people, I would say, always, I don't ask them to not drink or anything else. Mm-hmm. I would say, just consider if you do drink, how much you drink and so on.
Yeah, yeah.
And just consider as well, you can become addicted and you can't get away from it. And it's a real burden and it's a distraction the rest of your life, you know.
Yeah.
Now, there's no good in me talking and preaching against drink because people have the option, and as far as I'm concerned, I respect people no matter what race they are, where they're from or anything else, what age they are or anything else as well. And I always say to our young people, never ask yourself who do you think you are. Ask yourself who do you think you could be.
Excellent. And how many in family now, Ian? Extended. How many grandchildren do you have?
I never counted them, Joe, to be honest.
You know them at Christmas. And how did you manage? How did you? Because I'm looking at a photograph here in the mirror by Killian O'Brien. How many? How did you manage during the lockdown with such a big family? We all living close together, or what?
Well, no, we're living apart ourselves. Like, and the one thing I've done, I've observed what the regulations are, no matter where I go. And I think it's important, number one. And I think it's something we're going to have to live with, because I was through a period of diphtheria in the country, and it was quite demanding at that time. TB was another thing in the country in my lifetime too.
Yeah.
And people were in lockdown and so on, and sanatoriums and so on. So I was through all that period as well, Joe, and I recognise that from say. If you look at the planet now, if you look at the planet the year 1800, there were only 1 billion people on it.
Yeah.
There's 7.78 billion on it today. If you look at the six counties now and we'll say all the dispute that's going on between ourselves, there's only 1.8 million and we have about 5 or 6 down here. So, you know, it's pure ridiculous, and all they're talking about now is Brexit and about protocols and so on.
Well, we did it earlier on. It's incredible the difference it's going to make. The difference is already making, but anyway. Well, and the awkwardness.
Joe, can you understand, when I was growing up and when I got married and all, there were no such thing yet, needing planning permission or nothing else. You could go out and build what you wanted.
Mm.
And nobody built anything that I see was detrimental to the way of life for anybody. So we have become so law-abiding and so enforcing and everything else. And so, listen, ring any of the agencies. Ring ESB. Ring Aircom. Ring anybody. See how long you'll be on the phone. Ring Irish Water. See how long you'll be on the phone.
I know. Hanging on, you mean? Hanging on, listening to music and trying to get something done.
I know you're talking push button A, B and C.
A, B and C. That's harsh.
But apart from anything else, what I did say to you, joking aside, people like you should come to a town like Drumilton, because I'll tell you why. There's so many small towns around us as well, from Glenveigh, Wrighton and all the rest of it, to the like of Rathmullen and so on. And even we're at the head, we're south of two peninsulas, the Roscoe Peninsula and the Fanna Peninsula. And there's no empty, we'll say, coastal areas where it's a pleasure to visit. And the other thing I will say as well, the people of Donegal, I would say, without exception, are very accommodating and very friendly as well.
Absolutely.
You know, and...
Well, the closest I've been to you recently was when I was filming The Meaning of Life. We were up in Derry for a few days. Well, that's the closest I got, but I was working. But the last year I went to Sleeve League up around that way. They were incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Very nice.
Incredible.
Very nice too. Very nice too.
So we a very happy birthday to you. What is the recipe for a long marriage?
Two words and only, Joe.
Say again?
2 words only.
Yeah.
No matter what's said, just say yes, dear.
Yes, dear, okay.
Keep walking.
Okay, good man. Yes, dear. Okay, Councillor Ian McGarvey, 67 years married. We reckon one of the longest in Ireland. And hale and hearty, himself and Marjorie. Ian has just celebrated his 94th birthday. Councillor Ian McGarvey, good to meet you, Margaret. Slangafall. Okay, back tomorrow, 1:45. Ray Darcy is next, and Sean O'Gorman produced.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
1850 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.